Hello, everyone, and welcome to Heard on the Street, Street Fights podcast, where we uncover the stories behind the companies and, more importantly, the people that constitute this sector of media and advertising that we all call local. So where are they from? What makes them tick? What business and life lessons can we draw from that? So I'm Mike Boland, lead analyst at Street Fight, and our guest today is Mike Davey, founder and CEO of Quadrant, which is an innovator in location intelligence. So we talked to Mike from our studio in San Francisco about the trends he's tracking and best practices he's exercising. So here's our discussion with Mike Davey. So Mike, welcome to the program.
Mike, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So we have a lot to talk about, including diving deeper into everything I just mentioned. But first, let's start with a quick intro for you and for Quadrant for those unfamiliar.
Yeah, so Quadrant is a location data and intelligence company. We see over around 500 million devices globally on a monthly basis, and we power a lot of location intelligence solutions globally.
Nice. And like I said, we're going to kind of circle back to that, find out how you guys differentiate the location collection methodology, all that good stuff. But first, what we're going to do, as we like to do on the show, is hit the rewind button and go back to the start of your career and kind of work back towards the present. So kind of what got you into all of this?
Yeah, sounds good. Yeah, going back all the way, as a young kid, I'm a Canadian, you might tell from my accent throughout the conversation. I grew up in Toronto, and I was always interested in technology. And when I was young, I said I'd one day go to China, to Hong Kong, because I was always fascinated with the different technologies of the world. Fast forward to 2005, I was graduating from university. I started off in computer science, graduated in international business and management science, and basically, you know, took a suitcase, went over to China, and started working in new technology. At the time, the world was just deploying 3G. So this is before your iPhones. This is 2005 era, mm-hmm. Where, you know, the networks were becoming digital. So there was a lot of new technology coming out. And so we were building a lot of the networks globally. And I was OEMing new technologies into Huawei. So Huawei wasn't even a name at that time.
Yeah.
When they were just starting to get out there. And we were basically bringing the latest technology to them and helping them building their infrastructure. And that really got me to see a lot of what goes on in the networks. I worked on the last product I worked on there was called Deep Packet Inspection, where you can see everything that goes, it flows across networks. And the amount of data even back then was just incomprehensible to the average person, what was actually flowing and what could be done with this type of data. Fast forward, I got hired into Samsung in their head office to basically look at mobile technology and commercializing the next generation of smartphones. You know, this is the Galaxy S1 to Galaxy S4 era, mm-hmm. Where we're looking at, you know, where do we take technology and where is it going to go and how do we commercialize this? From there, worked in LTE when deploying LTE network equipment. And when we were going meeting up with operators, they didn't really care about, you know, how fast the internet was going to be, and they didn't really care about how great the next new shiny phone was. They wanted to know what they can do with the data. The data that, like, with the advent of the Internet of Things, they knew that there's going to be a lot of data going across the network, like 100x compared to what it currently was. And they wanted to know, you know, how do we build new services out of this? What does the future of data look like? And so, yeah, my path was always around looking at, you know, new services, new technology and new data and how that is going to change your lives and basically what are the new services that we can do.
That's great. So that kind of brings us to the present. So how did all that lead into the founding of Quadrant? Tell us a little bit about the founding story, the drivers, the inception.
Yeah. So when in my time in Samsung, I was also doing my master's. And at the time, we were looking at a lot of real-time stream processing. And we could see that in the telcos, like one of our clients, Sprint, they would go to a base station and with a truck and download 1 hour's worth of data, and then they go back and analyze it, and everything else would get dumped just because there's so much data that couldn't be processed in real time, and it was just too costly. And so when we were like looking for solutions on how people could transact and make use of this data, there really wasn't much there. So serendipitously, me doing my master's, I got selected by Amazon to be one of their first public beta testers of a new streaming technology called Kinesis, and where all of a sudden we could do a scalable solution on enabling real-time feeds between companies. And that sort of was like the aha moment where I said, wait a second, we can now scale this. We don't have to deploy huge data centers just to get this a company like this off the ground. We can use some AWS services that will enable us to create this scalable infrastructure to enable companies to basically transact real-time feeds between each other. And that's sort of where the company came from. That's what we started off on, was a data marketplace where we would enable all types of data, all types of streaming data between organizations. But then in 2016, that's when a lot of companies started coming to us from the US saying, look, we're looking for location data. Do you have this? Where can you get this? And then at the same time, we had SDK providers and publishers saying, hey, we have this data. What can we do with it? And it's sort of like, let's just connect the pieces here. And then we built the company around that. We continued to build the company around that and then focus on location intelligence. And that was sort of part of the branding change in 2018. Like, we were working with some of the biggest data providers, billion-dollar companies in the world, your FactSets, your Reuters, your Singtels, they were all our clients. But we realized that location intelligence is really the future for a lot of industries. And so we sort of narrowed our focus strictly on that type of data feeds.
Yeah, and it's interesting. We see that a lot of companies have probably sensed those same demand signals, and that has led to this kind of blooming of several location intelligence providers. So that's in some ways the byproduct of that has been some degree of kind of confusion out there about location data, because there are lots of different collection methodologies. Some have more integrity than others. So how do you guys differentiate in terms of your methodology and how that is something you stand behind?
Yeah, so the first thing is you have to really understand what type of data is out there and the different levels. The key thing is whenever we talk to clients and that, it's like, what is your data use case? What are you trying to solve?
Yep.
Because there is no like good data, bad data. It's a matter of, does the data fit my use case? And that's the first key thing that everybody needs to understand when they're looking for location data, is that that you need to understand first your use case and then finding which feeds, which sources are going to be the best. And so for us, we really focus on SDK data derived from GPS. And that's really what our clients are looking for too. But something like beacons or Wi-Fi, they can be great in certain situations that would be better than SDK data. But it just really depends what you're looking for. So where we focus on is really around the SDK GPS data, both foreground, background, and why our clients select us and work with us is just because we have a big breadth of the data and we understand it, and that we're not just like throwing data over the fence and saying, hey, you go deal with it. We actually understand the clients, what they're looking for, and are able to actually provide them the exact feeds that they're looking to ch achieve whatever business goals they have. We have a data science team, which is five strong, and a data engineer, three data engineers. So we really are in a position to actually help our clients, and we find ourselves actually doing a lot of education. So even the people who are consuming, some of the biggest consumers of data, don't even understand a lot of times what they're receiving.
Yeah, no, that's. I think it's a good point that data in itself is not very valuable. It's the insights gleaned from it, and I think you mentioned use cases. That's interesting too, because we've seen this evolution in the location data collection, location intelligence space, where primarily it was used for ad targeting or attribution. Post ad exposure and what happened in terms of tracking people into a store or whatever the case may be. But I think we're seeing these interesting uses and use cases develop that go beyond kind of advertising and marketing to inform, company operational strategy, whether it be things like, inventory management or things like, fleet tracking, asset tracking, all kinds of interesting things that are developing. So what are the ones that you guys are zeroing on, in on most?
Yeah, so there's two things on it. There's the like when you look at the ad tech sales and marketing, that's where a lot of the money is right now because it's a really easy use case. And so when you look at the balance between what's interesting and what is selling. There's always that balance you have to understand in that MarTech and ad tech. That's where a lot of the use cases you'll see. But we are seeing people becoming more sophisticated, and it's fantastic. Like, we've seen interesting use cases, like for infrastructure development, understanding where to put train, like a train, high speed trains in, by analyzing people, by analyzing like migration between countries on daily basis, like where people cross the border, what do they do, where's the workplace that they go to, and they're making billion-dollar decisions on roads and infrastructure based on understanding more ground level information. And we had one case where it's funny that I asked him, like, how are you currently doing? How are you currently getting this type of data? And this is for a separate case where it's a logistics company who is moving into the Indian market, and they're looking at where do we put our next distribution centers and retail points. And I said, "Oh, we just send people out counting?" And actually, that's what we did. Last week, we sent people to stand on the corner of the streets and pushing in an Android app they developed, push it every single time somebody walked by. I'm like, you don't need to do that anymore. You have avenues to collect this data. So we see, we see interesting cases from understanding like where to put storefronts, where to put public infrastructure, understanding migration patterns, disease control as well, understanding the spread of disease. So some of these cases you can do quite well. Some of them are still under development on what realistically you can do with location intelligence data.
Yeah, and your example also reminds me of the methodology for proving the efficacy of a lot of outdoor advertising like billboards, which has happened up until recently. It might actually still be happening with non-digital out of home advertising, where it's essentially counting the cars that go by. And go ahead.
Yeah, I was gonna say, that's how it used to work. But actually, one of our public clients called Quorum, they're digitalizing that. So, that they're looking at actually seeing where the car, who goes by it, where do they go after. So, providing intelligence even to the non-digital boards, but using location data and their own algorithms to understand, okay, who went by this, who went by these billboards, where did they go after, where did they come from, how many people did see it. So, we are seeing even the non-digital out of home being now brought into this the digital era.
Absolutely. And another interesting example of location science being applied that isn't necessarily anything new, but it's something we've been tracking for a few years and always find interesting, which is, hedge fund managers using location data to gain an edge in terms of intelligence that would, sway any kind of investment decisions. And that practice goes back a long time in terms of things like using satellite imagery to see how many cars are in the Walmart parking lot throughout the quarter and using that to extrapolate their, upcoming earnings, but in this way, a more precise way of doing it through things like foot traffic. So we're actually going to pause there for a quick commercial break. When we come back, more with Mike Davey. Hello everyone, this is Mike Bolin, lead analyst at Street Fight, and I'd like to talk to you today about Brandify, which is Street Fight's parent company. It's a local marketing company that provides a range of services for brands with brick and mortar store locations. So that's everything from retail stores to restaurants and moving companies and banks and healthcare providers and several other verticals. And Brandify manages the digital outposts where most consumers encounter these businesses today. So we're talking Google Maps and Facebook, Yelp, Apple Maps, and Bing. And the name of the game is really to create a compelling presence on these sites and apps and to engage with consumers more effectively using advanced reputation management tools. And this is all really compelled by the fact that 97% of consumers regularly search online for local businesses. So brands today can't afford to be missing from all those channels or lack multimedia content or contact information or visible responses to customer feedback. So Brandify synthesizes and optimizes all these channels through a local marketing platform. And it's all about standing out and winning the loyalty and lifetime value of tech-savvy consumers. So to learn more, visit Brandify.com. So we're back. My guest is Mike Davey. So Mike, before the break, we were talking about some of the location intelligence use cases that Quadrant is tackling and some of the underlying technology. So that leads to the question of, companies out there that are new at location data, that are consumers of location data, and starting to decide how they want to use it to inform their logistics, as you mentioned, or their MarTech and those, some of those other use cases. Like, what should they be looking for? What should they be asking?
Yeah, well, the first thing, if you're the new company, you really want to understand what your use case is and what are the metrics that are going to solve that. And we find a lot of companies don't understand that yet. They don't understand really what is the problem they're trying to solve and what would the data have to look like for them to solve it. So that would be the first thing that anybody should really sit down and think about is this, instead of just trying to find, oh, I want more data or want more scale, that it's like, okay, what do I actually need that to look like? Yeah. Do I need to understand how somebody does like 80% of their day, or do I just need to see their data, see the ad ID and understand that it exists?
Yep.
And so the first thing is to basically classify what would the data need to look like to solve the problem. And then from there is that you'd have to then see if your provider can actually provide that data for you, either in a derived format or is it included in. And so like for us, for example, like when we look at our data feeds, like we produce quality reports every month on our different feeds. So people can see things like the number of events that people see per day, the number of days you see them in a month, how many the ad IDs do you see per hour. And so people can get a good picture of what the quality looks like of the main feeds and of each feed. And that will really help to sort of say, okay, does this hit my use case?
Yeah.
And so some of the metrics that we see right now that people sort of get caught up on are like, okay, how many events a day do I see somebody? And that has been like, say from 2018, people have been, oh yeah, now I want to see at least 100 events per day. But if you see 100 events at the person's house and they just sit there and it's only over the course of 4 minutes, is that really a good metric to be going on?
Right.
If you're trying to find out what stores they went to. So what we're seeing these days is that people have to be more sophisticated, have to understand what their use case is, and then have partners who can actually have an educated conversation with them on if they can provide that data. What we do find is that sometimes the providers also don't even know what their data is and they can't answer these questions. That when you look at the location industry, as you mentioned earlier, is that there's a lot of people in it. There's a huge market here from, you know, your small like publishers who are now releasing their like individual app data to you have like large aggregators that are just sort of collecting and throwing over the fence saying, you know, just take all this data and do whatever you want with it. And there's everybody in between that you really want to get a partner who can actually provide you what you're looking for your use case and not get distracted by some of the superficial metrics out there.
Yeah. So it's goal oriented. It's a solution sell and not a technology sell. That resonates well. So do you have any examples of, you know, clients that you've worked with where you've helped them achieve a certain metric towards those, you know, those concrete goals?
Yeah. So when you look at our product lines and the location fees, we have two main products. One's called Hydra, and this one is almost a half a billion devices that you see per month. And with that one, it has everything in it. So what people want to use the word quality, you can say you have low quality, high quality, but you know, I don't like the quality is always subjective to the use case.
Yep.
But it has a lot of data where you only see somebody once a month. And so use cases like that have been really successful for clients who are just trying to understand, you know, how many people use a Galaxy S6 or Galaxy S10 now, how many people are switching their phones, what people have an iPhone in these regions, and having a lot of data, but just a small amount of events is actually perfect for them because that's what their use case is. Where we have other people who are doing attribution and measurement, they're like, you know what, that data is not going to help us at all. Can you just remove these low events, low density app IDs and just provide us with feeds that we see people at least for 3 hours a day and at least 20 points per day and at a horizontal accuracy of less than, you know, 150 meters because we want to actually, like, you know, understand their places or their visits to stores. Mm-hmm. And so we provide them a much more refined feed, so they're not having to over process. We provide our main feed is over 80 gigabytes a day, which can overwhelm some people.
Yeah, sure. So Beyond some of the use cases and verticals, you mentioned logistics, and we talked a little bit about ad tech, martech. What areas, if any, are you interested in expanding to that you believe might be underserved, whether that be use cases, whether it be business verticals, or perhaps, the current clients you're working with? Is there any kind of feature expansion on your roadmap that you can talk about?
Yeah, so there's a couple layers to the question. So the first thing in terms of our strategy here, with Quadrant, we are a global company, but our head office is based in Singapore. Mm-hmm. We do business heavily in the U.S. As well as in APAC. In APAC and U.S. are two different markets and maturity level. In the U.S. or sort of North America, we provide the raw feeds and we power many of the leading location-based companies, location intelligence companies in the ad tech space. And so we provide the raw feeds there. And so their feature set going forward looks a little different than APAC, where APAC, you don't really have that many location intelligence firms. You don't really have many people doing attribution and audiences. So it's a very different roadmap for the APAC market. So when you look at the U.S., a lot of our work right now is around compliance, transparency. Over the last, since we've been dealing since 2016 in the U.S. market, and we've seen a lot of changes going on every, 6 months. The regulations change and perspectives change, and that we see it evolving where transparency is more and more important. So we use blockchain technology to start tracing the value chain of where this data has come from. So previously, people really didn't care about that, and a lot of people still don't in the U.S., but with the California Privacy Acts coming up and GDPR already in force in the EU, that we're seeing that it's going to go that way. So in the past, a lot of people, they say, hey, what publishers do you work with, or where does your data come from? People would always say, oh, we're not going to tell you. Those days are gone. So we're working on technologies there that will enable the transparency. So for compliance and regulation, as well as just for good business practices, that people don't want to be paying money for the same data twice.
Absolutely.
And so that's what our feature sets are in the U.S., and that's what we'll continue to build out there to ensure that we're getting more compliant, transparent data. In APAC, it's a little different. We actually do have an audience product out there. So we don't offer it in the U.S. or in North America, but audiences in APAC we do. So we work with your LotaMe's and your LiveRamp's dealing with agencies. So we're trying to basically educate and foster the market on understanding, the power of location data and how that's different, and why location intelligence much better than just like simply looking at, demographic behavior. So when you look at the audience industry in Southeast Asia mainly, that you see that, they would just say, okay, I want to advertise to people who are between 25 to 40. So they'll say, okay, the average person who buys a BMW is, say 35 to 45. Let's just show all of our ads to that person, where that's just, you're just flushing money down the toilet. Just because people who own a BMW are 35 to 45, it doesn't mean that 35 to 45-year-olds are trying to buy a BMW. That's where location intelligence can really differentiate and help out agencies and brands. And so we're building out more and more those services in that market.
Yeah, that's great. And let's drill down on the kind of the privacy and data integrity aspects that you mentioned. And you mentioned that you're operating in a very geographically distributed way, and different markets are at different levels of maturity and lots of other factors. But one other kind of vector there is all of these different markets are operating at different levels of compliance. And you alluded to that as well. It's always been my theory that companies that are spread across geographically in terms of their coverage and gaining location intelligence are probably better suited, because they are forced to, in order to have consistent methodologies across the board, kind of reach the most stringent of all of the geographic areas they are operating in terms of compliance, and therefore are probably on top of their privacy game. So is that a fair statement? And then also, just generally, what are your kind of philosophies as a company and policies around privacy?
Yeah. So to answer the first question, yeah, I guess that is true, because with EU, the GDPR, I'd say, is the most stringent. So mm-hmm. even with the California laws coming in, if you're GDPR compliant, then
you're already in.
You'll be compliant. You're already in. So it is true that we have to abide by, and we have to look at like every single country on an individual level. It becomes costly. It is not an easy endeavor, but you're right that if you're going to be creating a back-end system, you're going to create it for the one that is the most stringent, or whatever markets that you're dealing with. And so you have to plan for that. And so for us, right now we are just as we are putting new tools in that will make us GDPR compliant, and that's then all the other regulations sort of easy to follow if you can follow GDPR. And then to your second point, so our philosophies on this. So the first thing, I love regulation. Regulation is great. I think regulation though needs to protect people. It protects citizens and improves citizen lives. Governments need their role is to ensure that their citizens have a better quality of life or an always improving, and that they don't get screwed over by corporations. So with that, we should be creating privacy laws and regulation in the data space that sort of enables that, that enables citizens to be protected, but at the same time enable companies to offer new services and better services and improve the lives of the citizens, our daily tasks. When it comes to GDPR and this data protection, I see it going the wrong way. A couple of years ago when GDPR was coming in, people were starting to look at it. I analyze them. It's like this is not going to protect people, and it's also all it's going to do is protect major corporations and put up walls and stifle innovation. And now that it's live, that's exactly what's going on. When you have Facebook saying, "Hey, GDPR is great," and Apple saying, "Yeah, we're doing privacy," they're not doing privacy. All they're doing is just limiting the data other people can collect, so then they can become more powerful. And so that's number one, is that it's not protecting people. Facebook is still collecting data. Google's still collecting everything. And what we're seeing is sort of the negative aspects of it is one is that it's costing small businesses a lot of money to be GDPR compliant, or even try to be 80% GDPR compliant. It costs millions. It's not an easy thing to do, especially if you're in the advertising space. With IAB, they have their version one coming out, and version two is coming out for their consent management systems. That these are costly things to do, and they're not really adding that much value. We see like one of the big cases I just saw last week, not a big case, but it's like a good case of why GDPR is not that great, is one of the regulations states that somebody must have the right, can contact any company and have the right to know what data they have on them. And so this is supposed to be a protection mechanism. But there was this one researcher who he just pretended to be his wife, went to 150 companies, and then gave them forged documents, and they released everything from her social security number to her passwords to her usernames. And so it's just amazing. Like 38 of companies didn't even question. She just emailed and they gave all the data. And so this whole law that was to enable protection of citizens is actually doing the exact opposite. And so I think that we need to really think about what we're trying to achieve. So the government has to understand, is it the collection and sharing of data that's a problem, or is it the way people use the data? And I would advocate that we need to protect people, make sure that they're not screwed. Like example being using data to reject for healthcare. Being Canadian, I do believe in universal healthcare. And if all of a sudden insurance companies are asking for data and rejecting people based on data, I don't like that. That's where the laws should be in, not saying, "Hey, small company, you're not allowed to get data," whereas Google and Facebook and everybody's just hoarding it.
And with California's legislation looming, is it moving in those same negative directions, or is now the opportunity to kind of see what we did wrong with GDPR and fix it? Or where do you see that going?
I think the California, the legislation that's coming in, I think was written earlier. So I think that there's still a lot of it's only coming to the surface now, a lot of the things that are wrong with GDPR. And a lot of people don't even realize, and I don't think a lot of people in the US realize some of the negative cases that are going on as well, that aren't not like the one that regarding privacy, regarding this researcher. I do recommend that any of our listeners look into that to understand like how this person easily hacked into and got all the privacy data from people. It's really astonishing. But even on a business level, there was one study, a case I heard behind closed doors, was regarding one of the automobile manufacturers, that they sent out, okay, due to GDPR, we have to ask you do you want to receive any more information from us? And of course, no one answered that email, right? No one said, oh yeah, please send me more information. And so they had to purge their entire, like the vast majority, vast, vast, vast majority of their consumer database, purge it, delete it. And now people are going back to them irate because they stopped doing their oil changes because they weren't getting the notifications on when to get their oil change. And this is like a premium car manufacturer from Europe. And they got screwed. So all the customers, didn't help them.
Yeah.
It's just that people just didn't want to respond to the email saying, hey, are we allowed to do things? So we see things like that actually lowering the service level companies can offer their clients who actually want these services, but just don't understand when they don't click the box, what they're saying, actually saying no to. And let's be honest, we don't read, even when it's in plain English,
right.
We're not going through reading these privacy statements, that nothing has really changed regarding how we view consent mechanisms.
Yeah. So we're actually going to pause there for a commercial break. When we come back, more from Mike Davey. Hello, everyone. This is Mike Bolin, lead analyst at Street Fight, and I'd like to talk to you today about Brandify, which is Street Fight's parent company. It's a local marketing company that provides a range of services for brands with brick and mortar store locations. So that's everything from retail stores to restaurants and moving companies and banks and healthcare providers and several other verticals. And Brandify manages the digital outposts where most consumers encounter these businesses today. So we're talking Google Maps and Facebook, Yelp, Apple Maps, and Bing. And the name of the game is really to create a compelling presence on these sites and apps and to engage with consumers more effectively using advanced reputation management tools. And this is all really compelled by the fact that 97% of consumers regularly search online for local businesses. So brands today can't afford to be missing from all those channels or lack multimedia content or contact information or visible responses to customer feedback. So Brandify synthesizes and optimizes all these channels through a local marketing platform. And it's all about standing out and winning the loyalty and lifetime value of tech-savvy consumers. So to learn more, visit Brandify.com. So we're back. My guest is Mike Davey. So Mike, before the break, we were talking about lots of heavy talk about privacy regulation and your well-founded opinions on where we need to go there. So we're going to lighten things up a little bit now and go into our lightning round. So what is a profession that you would want to have if you weren't doing what you do now?
I'd like to code. I'm always jealous of Roger, who heads our data science, and Shrew, who does our data engineering. They just get to code all day long. I'd write algorithms in my basement.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm a self-taught basic coder, just with like web development, and I always find it very, very soothing, heads down work, and I do a lot of writing too. I think they're very similar in terms of the cadence and the, you know, the types of personality types that are drawn to both of those in terms of heads down work. It's like solving a puzzle. And that's great. I share that answer with you. What is a company or tech startup that you think it would be most exciting to be a part of at early stages?
That's at Palantir.
Ah, nice.
I think they do some interesting things in the background. They see a lot of data and a lot of the different use cases that people can do. So I think Palantir would be my option there.
That's great. We haven't heard that answer yet. I like that. What's your favorite tech product or app that you use as a consumer?
Oh, I guess my Suunto watch for training. It's does it logs all my heart rate and makes sure that when I'm exercising that I'm doing it in the right uses data to make sure I'm still in my zone. So I like my Suunto watch.
That's great. I just bought my wife an Apple Watch for her birthday. And one of the reasons, well, you know, the primary reason was for her. But in the back of my head, I was thinking, I'm going to wear this thing for a few days and then decide if I would like to join the kind of quantified self movement. I really like it on theoretical levels. And so I may get there soon. So who's someone from the business world that you admire most?
This is probably on a lot of people's list, but for different reasons. Elon Musk.
Yeah.
Just because he's a little bit strange and a little bit out there,
right?
But he's getting the job done.
Yeah,
so, I do like his quirkiness, and even though he's a little unpolished at times, I think I
Yeah,
am too.
and sometimes his quirkiness and unpolishedness, sometimes I give him a pass because the guy, probably sleeps like 2 hours a night and probably has enough money to not need to do that, but he just works like ungodly hours. And which is not necessarily something that, lesson for the kids, but it is admirable in some ways in terms of work ethic.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, I think it's, a lot of people are different on what they view of work-life balance. If you like
Right.
what you're doing, it's never work. So like, I love my job, and it's just, I don't even think it's a job. I just love what we do. And yeah, if I could do it 36 hours a day, I would.
Yeah, and everyone's balance is different. I think that's a great point. So, what are some passions or hobbies that help you mentally unplug from work?
I guess I never really unplug. I guess the only thing I try to unplug from is mentally don't unplug, but physically like to unplug from the phone and the computer so I can actually focus my mind on problem solving.
Yep.
And so what I do is I do Xterra, so off-road triathlon, so
Nice.
mountain biking, trail running, and ocean swimming. And that usually gives me 3 to 6 hours of just like focus on some problem. So I sort of go into automated mode. And do what I need to do for the sport, but at the same time, I'm sitting there problem solving the entire time. I like to
Yeah.
get away from the computer every once in a while, and I find that's the best way.
Yeah. Again, I'll invoke the art of writing, and it's very valuable to get away from a piece of work, come back to it 3 hours later or the next morning, look at it with a fresh eye. I think in two ways. One, it's a fresh eye, but also it lets your brain kind of go somewhere else for a while and solve problems in a different kind of context. So that's great. That makes a lot of sense. Lastly, what are some of your personal goals for the remainder of the year?
I guess for us, my personal goals are also company goals that we're currently expanding as well, and just building up a team of a bigger team. We're 24 people right now, and just trying to build a bigger team of people who are as enthusiastic about location data and what it can do as we are. So our personal goal is to continue to grow our team.
Yeah, that's great. And that's a good place to end it. So that's all the time we have. I want to thank you, Mike, for spending time with us.
No problem at all, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you all for listening. Stay tuned for future episodes of Herd on the Street. You can find us on streetfightmag.com. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts. Also, stay tuned for lots more writings and multimedia from Street Fight. So this has been Herd on the Street. I'm Mike Boland. Thanks for listening.